So I really like the concept of the bass. Its function in Western music is to be that mortar between the bricks. You know, you're the bridge between the harmonic and the rhythmic elements of an ensemble. And there's a lot of strength there. There's a lot of sort of leading from behind, you know, leading from the shadows, being someone you can be leaned upon to help build a great foundation for other people to do stuff. I like that role. I don't really need the spotlight.
Welcome to Rosin the Bow, an audio journey through the world of the violin family. I'm Joe McHugh, and in this two-part podcast, I will be talking with bassist Jeff Harshbarger, who hails from Lawrence, Kansas, home to the University of Kansas. I first heard Jeff play his bass as a member of the Purna Loka Quartet that included Purna Pragnau Banjare, an Indian classical violinist, David Balakrishnan, an American-born violinist and composer, and Amit Cowtaker, a master on the Indian drums, the tabla. The concert was held at the Lawrence Arts Center and was titled East Meets West. I traveled to Lawrence in the spring of 2017 to interview Purna and David, who had just completed a month-long collaboration on a composition that drew upon both Indian and Western musical forms. But I was so impressed with Jeff's artistry on the bass that I asked him if we might have a conversation about his relationship with this unique instrument, an instrument that has remained somewhat of a mystery to me.
My name is Jeff Harshbarger. We're in the beautiful KPR studios in Lawrence, Kansas, on the University of Kansas campus. I got my start, my parents are both music teachers. My father's a high school band teacher. My mom's a grade school music teacher. And they're trained, he's a jazz musician, woodwind specialist, and she's an opera singer.
Whereabouts?
I grew up in Manhattan, Kansas. And that's where the beginning of my music started. They put a violin in my hand when I was four. And Suzuki trained. His best friend was the orchestra teacher. So they started me pretty young on that and the piano. And I got a saxophone when I was 10 and an upright bass when electric bass when I was 10, upright when I was 11. And just public schools, that kind of business. But also subbed into my father's band and a couple other bands in the area when I was 10, just playing jazz standards gigs. Not because I was any good, but because in Manhattan, Kansas, there was only a couple other guys that could hold a bass. And when they couldn't do it, and one of them was a volunteer fireman, so he'd have to leave, you know, pretty quickly sometimes. And so the call would come in, can you let Jeff out the house? Mike's got to go put a building out, you know, and he can't make the gig tonight. And so my father, having played his way through school as a youngster, you know, trusted these fellas and, you know, how much trouble can you get into in rural Kansas, you know, middle of the state, there's not a whole lot of squirrely stuff going on. So I got fortunate to play with people way, way better than me when I was a very young age. And I learned a lot. I learned most of my standards then and just learned about getting the job done and staying out of the way, being supportive.
So you had this, the first was introduction of really playing an instrument was the violin.
Yeah.
But you gravitated to the bass. Was this because everyone needed a bassist or you have the nature of a bassist?
It's because my dad made me play the bass, to be totally honest. His friend, the orchestra teacher, says, you know, your kid is actually really large for his age. And I have a quarter-size bass in our locker that I've never been able to use. So if he felt like switching, I could actually have a bass player in my grade school orchestra. And by the time he got home that afternoon, he said, so you're going to start playing bass tomorrow. And I said, well, okay. You know, because you just did what your parents told you to do. And I ended up being okay at it. I ended up really liking it and gained a certain amount of respect on it. That keeps a young man, you know, going. You know, you become known for being good at something. So that was the sort of the in I had to my social network. So I stuck with it and just kind of said yes to everything. I played in all the school groups and was really active in the theater and really active in acting outside of school. But eventually did a lot of singing too, but eventually just gravitated towards being a bass player. And now later in life, I've reintroduced singing back into what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. It just seems like the natural progression to get back to it.
Yeah, there's a couple very popular singers, vocalists, who play bass simultaneously.
Oh, yeah. Yes. You know, typical child of the 80s, you know, listened to all the stuff that was on the radio, really loved The Police, you know, and looked up to Sting, looked up to Geddy Lee, because those were people that could sing interesting things, and they had a really strong melodic sense while playing interesting, intricate bass lines. It was mystifying to me. I felt those lines were not your typical, you know, boom, 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 boom. There was much more going on, and singing over that is really hard. I found that an intriguing challenge. I really enjoyed trying to do that. So that was the focus for a while until I got into jazz. Someone gave me a Kind of Blue, that Miles Davis record, when I was 14, and that sort of changed everything. That was a watershed moment.
Can you tell me why?
I had never heard anything like it. My father was really interested in Dixieland and trad jazz, and Stan Getz and Phil Woods is about as modern as he got. And my mother listened to Verdi and light opera and Barbara Streisand, those kind of things. So that was the soundtrack of my early childhood. And then, you know, you discover the radio and your friends are into what they're into when you're a young person. That record, nothing had ever sounded like that. I didn't know music could be that way. And it was so, it seemed fragile and impassable at the same time. It seemed to have everything in it. And such distinct voices throughout that record. You know, people playing extremely melodically and very simply, and then some people playing extremely complicatedly over really simple ideas. And just the sound of it, just how the bass and the drums work together as like a single unit, just like a single voice, like two people sharing an idea at all times. Really loved that.
And this relationship between percussion and the bass, talk about that a little bit.
It's the key. I think we're all drummers with notes, you know, at the end of the day. You know, it's the earliest instrument. We're all singers and we're all drummers in our hearts and souls. And how we choose to manifest that is just different by our tastes. But as long as we have that in mind, it's hard to go wrong. You know, it's hard to stray from your true music. So I really like the concept of the bass. Its function in Western music is to be that mortar between the bricks. You know, you're the bridge between the harmonic and the rhythmic elements of an ensemble. And there's a lot of strength there. There's a lot of sort of leading from behind, you know, leading from the shadows, being someone you can be leaned upon to help build a great foundation for other people to do stuff. I like that role. I don't really need the spotlight. Don't mind it if it comes my way, but I don't need to live there. I would have chosen a different instrument if I did. I like to be part of a larger collective and to make a have a groupthink moment, to be collaborative. That's important to me.
I play what they call old-time music, Southern Appalachian string music.
Yeah.
And often you're at a festival and you're playing and you got a good guitarist with you and banjo, which is closer, has that percussive element.
Absolutely.
That's the drum with the notes. And you've got this groove going and you're really enjoying it. And often you won't even notice because there's a lot of people, you're outdoors, might could be night. Mm-hmm. And suddenly there's somebody with a stand-up bass who just showed up, and they put the floor under you.
Yeah.
And it's like the thing is a whole new dimension. You just go into another place altogether, yeah. And everybody feels it, and it's electric.
Yeah, it's just this big, beautiful, doughy, like, woof. You know, it's an amazing feeling. You know, yeah. Playing the instrument's amazing, too. It's such a big, resonant box, and it resonates with you once you learn how to dance with it a little bit and to not choke the box from vibrating. It's such a large cavity. When you figure out how to make it, you know, sing on its own.
Tell us a little bit more about that. Just as if you were talking to somebody who's starting on this, this idea I love of letting the box vibrate and not choking it. How would you choke it with literally your body against it?
Yeah. If you just lay, some people will play it to the side, especially if you're mostly playing pizzicato. So you've got the right rib laying against your belly, and that's actually destroying vibration. You know, the box isn't going to make as much sound because you're choking it off. Or sometimes you can even hold it perfectly away from you, but you're putting too much weight down on it. There's a lot of ways you can influence the tone of the instrument just by how you hold it. And I don't want to say that's bad. I think those are valid choices. You know, frequently, depending on the kind of music I play, I will turn the instrument and I will lay it against my belly so I can get a more choked, thuddy sound, because it would be appropriate for the thing that I'm doing. But otherwise, if I want to have some really singing arco melodies, you've got to turn the instrument. You've got to have it so that all the flat surfaces can vibrate on their own. I think that's really important. And I think trying to have your instrument set up so that it's free to vibrate, like removing as much excess material from the instrument as possible, it's made a big difference on my bass. I've noticed it. Changing my tailpiece to something that's a little more standard than what was on it originally, removing cables and replacing it with leather. I've gone back and forth to all these things. I've tried lots of different kinds of strings and just to see what the bass wants to do. And it's an old instrument. You know, it's a 19th century instrument. So
the one you're playing.
Yeah.
Tell me about that instrument a little bit.
We don't know who made it, which is probably the reason why I can afford it, being as old as it is. We guess the fellow I bought it from, he thinks it's an 1870s thereabout. German flatback, and it's just warm and round. And honest, it's the first old instrument I've ever owned, and I always wanted an old instrument. I just gravitated towards that sound. I don't think there's anything like it. But I had owned it for less than a month, and it was decapitated by a drunk in a bar. Oh. The guy didn't see it. He kicked it across the room, and he was a very smart drunk. He ran very quickly. Once I heard the big sound, he was really nowhere to be found. So that was pretty heartbreaking. It had a very thick neck on it. And I bought the bass because it just had that woof. It just had that huge bottom end, that huge sound. And I made a mistake when I had it rebuilt. I was talked into a neck graft, which is a very great repair. And the guys who did it did a great job. It's the original scroll, the original body, and a new neck. And I just figured, well, let's just carve a good D neck into it. I'm starting to travel more. It's harder to take your own bass around the world. So I want to get used to what's become a standard way of playing the bass. And I'll just take this opportunity to have my bass geared towards that. So I feel better all the time. And in retrospect, I should have just had the old neck replaced in on a pin job. It's not as sturdy of a repair, but I wouldn't have lost that sound. It doesn't do that anymore. It did that without any effort. I've had to rehabilitate the instrument to get close. And it has a great sound now, but it took me a couple of years to just get over the fact that I wasn't going to have the thing I bought it for. You know, it's a different sound than what I wanted. But it's fine. It's led me towards other kinds of music. I've been doing a lot more interesting chamber music lately that bass would not have been appropriate for with its old sound. Mm-hmm. And now that I've changed the string length and I've changed the gauge of the strings that I use, it's a more versatile instrument. I used to have a single voice. Now I have a wider palette. And so I'm thankful. So thank you, Mystery Drunk, for widening my palate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. These weird interventions of fate in one way or another. Can you see yourself having two different basses for fundamentally different kinds of music?
I own three. I have my old plywood bass that I grew up playing on. I've geared towards solo classical bass playing. And it's very thin strings, very low action, and it's forcing me to be lighter. I've had to buy different bows. I've had to change how I hold it because I'm a bit of a Cro-Magnon. I just kind of muscle my way through playing. And so forcing myself to play an instrument like that for practice is, man, that's a challenge. Just trying not to crush the string right into the fingerboard. I can't help it. half the time, the bass just goes clunk. Mm-hmm. So no, I don't enjoy playing that instrument, but I work on it because it teaches me a finesse it forces me into a finesse that the other instrument doesn't.
But you just use it for practice.
Yeah, I've used it for, I've used it for a couple of things, but it is a plywood instrument. It doesn't have the depth of tone that my main instrument does. So I think I've relegated it to just being in the living room and helping me learn other things.
Mm-hmm. And what's the third instrument?
The third instrument is another, it's an older plywood that I bought because a mentor of mine learned on it and it came up for sale. He said, hey, I haven't played the bass in a couple years and it needs to go to a good home. So it's my plywood beater bass. If I don't want to take the nice one to a couple of bars that I play at, I'll take this one along. It's good to have a second bass around. If a friend comes in from out of town, there's a nice instrument that I can loan somebody if whatever they're presented with isn't good. And it was important to me to buy because it was Dennis Irwin's instrument when he got fresh out of college. And he's a very important person in my life. And his college roommate, this great trombone player, Dave Glenn, he's the one who's had it for a long time. Bass is his second instrument. And he just wasn't using it anymore. And so he said, you know, come get it. So it's kind of an honor for me to have this instrument that one of my heroes learned on. It's got that juju in it, man. It's got that thing.
Well, you brought up this subject of traveling.
Mm-hmm.
And I have talked to other bassists about this, where often they can't travel with their bass.
Yeah.
Or if they do, it always gets broken.
Yeah.
Like it's a rule of the universe.
Yeah, yeah.
No matter how you pack it, it's going to arrive on the other end with some problem.
Yeah.
When you tour, you're getting whatever is there on the other side. And how do you figure out the bass you're going to need? Have you been in that situation very often, or do you usually just have your bass?
It's about half and half. Domestically, I get my bass because I'll figure out a way to travel that I can always use mine. But overseas, it's just become impossible. It's not worth it. And like you said, if I put it in the case and put it underneath the plane, every time something has happened to it and the bass doesn't do what I want it to do when it takes a few days for it to reacclimate. There's no real time when you're traveling on the road to get that chunk of 2 or 3 hours to get that bass where you want it. So I've learned to deal with what's there. I do a lot of research and I'm thankful that I've got enough friends now that I know enough people in different towns that I can make a couple phone calls and say, hey, do you know somebody in this town? You're a country over. Who do I get in contact with if I'm going to be there in a couple months? I'm going to need an instrument. I'm paranoid enough that if it's a major festival, they're always great. It's always a good instrument. I don't worry about it. I just tell them my basic specs and it's fun to play a different instrument because it's like it does a new thing. It gives me new ideas. And I'm playing a lot of improvisatory music, so it helps me have a new voice that night. I like it. But yeah, every one out of every 6 or 7 times, you get a real dog, and you just got to suck it up, man.
Nobody pays attention.
Oh, no, man. They go, oh, yeah, it's a bass, right? You get something that was in someone's basement for ages. Oh, the worst was one in Arkansas. It smelled like a cat box. It was so amazing. And it had 3 of 4 strings on it. And the action, it was like you could drive a truck between the strings and the fingerboard. It was just amazing.
What was the gig?
It was this touring, this group I had called Alaturka. It's a Turkish jazz ensemble. And so we were performing for the governor and a bunch of people at the university, like a bunch of intellectuals. It was a challenging gig. I'll say that. I'm glad that's over. But that's by far the worst bass I've seen. Yeah.
Sometimes. This is an interesting idea that there is a social imperative, if that's the right word, to have this network of people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we make friends for the sake of our affections, and we like those friendships to be spontaneous and not manipulative. But a lot of people don't understand the nature of social capital anymore.
Right,
so you got to pay into the bank.
Yeah,
and it's not manipulative to be pleasant and good mannered with other people, so that when you in fact need them, but then when they need you, you're there too for them. But
yeah.
I come from an Irish family and they were good politicians because there was a chit, I think it was the word they used to use.
Right.
Like, well, he owes me.
Right.
Even though I did it, I would have done it for him anyhow. But now I can call on him rather than go to somebody and just ask for something, and you there's no money in that bank, the social bank. So just a little bit about the camaraderie within the world of bassists. Do they see themselves as their own clan? And in a different way, maybe, than other people in the violin world? Maybe I'm fishing for that.
No, I think the trials of what you have to deal with being a bass player, especially a traveling bass player, are so unique that we really bond over that. You know, whenever you go to a jazz convention or you go to the ISB convention and you're hanging out with a bunch of bass players, it doesn't take very long for you to start talking about all your travel horror stories, because it's just common ground. We all have them, and everyone loves to hear the different flavor of it. And it's all, you know, there's probably only four or five stories, but how they happened is the glory in telling those tales over drinks. And when people are coming through your town, I make it a point to go to the gigs when there's players that I really love, and I'm coming from another session anyway, so the bass is already in the car. So I don't leave it in the car. I bring it in and I go backstage, and sometimes I've seen guys like really struggling, and I'll just introduce myself and said, "Hey, I just came from my own session. I was coming to your show tonight. You're welcome to use my instrument if you want." And I've met some wonderful people that way, just by being, by wanting to see a good show. Like, I feel like I'm hurting myself if I've taken a night off of work to go see someone else play and I can't watch them play the way they want to because they're struggling with the equipment. And it's like, well, man, I know I've got a good instrument, so just take it. And I get to hear you kick ass as opposed to like not do the thing I know you can do. Like, we're all in this together. We're all on the same team. Like, that's the glory of it. And bass players, I think that more so than most people, because you're usually only one of us on a gig, unless you're in the symphonic world. So we don't really get to see each other that often. You have to really go out of your way to hang out. So that camaraderie happens really quickly. If you find a fellow bass player that you get along with, there's guys I've met at a festival, you know, once, that will chat up on social media, we'll catch up on the phone once in a while, but we really only had one encounter face to face, and I would consider them dear friends, just because that it just happens that way. It happens really quickly. I think quicker than most. And if you decide someone's just not someone you want to mess with, you decide that pretty quick too, and you just move on. But being helpful and understanding like what it is that we've got to do to have a good gig, I run into more people that think that way than don't.
You're making me think for some reason of the book by Malcolm Gladwell called Blink. And the book is basically about this ability human beings seem to have to size up someone in a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
The example he first gave was they showed a professor to these students that could either take his class or not take his class and then rate him. And they would show him 30 seconds of this man teaching a class. And then they would rate. And then it turns out when they rated them later, they evaluated the professor. It turned out to be true.
Right.
You know, that he was boring or he was exciting or she was, whatever. Then they turned it, I think, down to 10 seconds. And they got it to like 5 seconds. So, I mean, incredibly short amount of time.
Right.
That apparently we can jump to a pretty accurate assessment of something.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering about, it just went through my mind as we were talking, the bass. You hear those first couple notes, and do you just like know right away?
Yeah.
This guy knows or this woman knows what she's doing?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. There's so much information in one note on the bass that you know right away.
Yeah.
There's so much going on. Yeah, it can be something as simple as someone just holding a single pitch, and you know a lot about that person. And you kind of know if you want to hang out with them or not. It's pretty, you know, if you can tell if someone is a supportive musician, they're probably someone that you can have a beer with. And if someone is like only hot-dogging all the time, you can have a beer with them too, but you're going to hear their stories. You're not going to get any of your own out. That's fine too. It's good. You know, it takes all kinds of people to do this stuff. And I've met very few people that I wouldn't share another beer with.
Well, this thing, I don't know why I'm going to put this in at this point, just again, things that pop into your head in a conversation, which is what I like. I like conversations. The fellow who was, and I wish I could think of his name right now, the famous producer for the Beatles.
Yeah, Martin.
Yeah, just passed away.
Yeah.
He had a story that he told to Paul McCartney that Paul McCartney then related. Mm. And what had happened was they were had just met him as musicians, the Beatles. And he brought him in and he was testing the range of their hearing, what frequencies they could hear. Huh. Turns out they have a remarkable hearing, all four of them. They could hear quite low and quite high in the spectrum. And then Martin told a story where he said that Hitler and Goebbels particularly, who really understood these emerging technologies and it's their relationship to political power, they would in these indoor gymnasiums, large places where Hitler was to give a talk, they would run a tone through the sound system that was just below human threshold for hearing. But it's a tone that low that makes people feel quite almost a little queasy and anxious, although they don't hear it with their ear or would know they do. Mm-hmm. Their body's obviously picking it up. And they would run this solid tone. And just as soon as Hitler came out onto the podium, they'd cut it.
Oh, wow.
And there'd be this euphoria, this lifting of something that nobody even knew, and they would just feel better, and here's the great leader, and I feel better.
Wow. I had not heard that yet.
That's an interesting story. So, you know, and you're down there. You're right down at that low end.
Oh, yeah.
Where this stuff's going on.
Yeah, there are times that you can really play with that. You know, I play a lot of avant-garde free music, and I'm constantly thinking about what kind of emotional effect I can have on what's happening. It's not necessarily about the notes that I'm playing, but it's about the sound I can generate. And by grinding away at the bottom end of the instrument and even detuning to get a little lower to pitches where, you know, the bottom of the bass is right about the spot where humans have a hard time discerning pitch, depending on who you are and where you're from and how old you are.
Is it 100 hertz?
I don't know. I think it's even lower. I think it's like 55. If I do the math real quick, my tuning, I use 220, and then the one below is 110. So yeah, it's got to be right around 65, 70, 55. And in there, you know, I've done ear training studies with a lot of my students, and I've noticed if you just play mix fourths and fifths and go down the piano, right around the range when you're at the bottom of the bass is where people start making mistakes. And people that have really great hearing, and most bass players can get, you know, almost an octave below that because you're just used to being down there. But hardly anybody else can. Like they just, you get down to the bottom E and then they just get lost after it. It's just a rumble to them. But it's really great to play with that and to use that against what other people are doing in an ensemble. Because I can create an unease or a nausea or a euphoria by, you know, relaxing that sound. If I'm popping things up an octave really quickly, it sort of lightens things up. If you pop things up too high, the bottom drops out, and that can create a lot of unease and a lot of tension.
Yeah, like the floor just went out from under them.
Yeah, it's like now there's nothing to stand on. Now we're all up in the air together. You know, and it's a different kind of tension. It's a different kind of a conversation that start happening amongst the musicians. You get really on point. You know, there's no longer a... I really like doing it to when certain people I play with get kind of stuck in their own. You can feel them stuck in their own head when they're soloing. They feel like they're soloing, even though it's free improvisation, which is, in my mind, better if we're all being really collaborative, if we're all like trying to be like a flock of seagulls together. Once in a while, someone gets in their own head, and it's great. They're having their moment, but then to help destroy that moment, I stop being a bass player. I get way up high on the instrument and remove that safety net for them. And instantly you feel the unease and the discomfort and you just, they snap their attention straight back to what everyone else is doing. It grounds them without having any ground.
Yeah.
It's super fun. I
like, you don't have to say anything or give anybody a dirty look. You just do it.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like I'm making a power play, but for me, it's more like being Bugs Bunny. It's just being mischievous. It's like, oh, you think you're going to have a big old solo now, do you? Bing! It's like, now, do it now. Now what's it sound like if you do the same thing? And to me, that's what free improv should be about. It should include a lot of playfulness. It should include a lot of gamesmanship. Mm-hmm. You know, it's much more fun, I think, for the listener and for the performer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Here is a short segment of music from the concert I attended at the Lawrence Arts Center in Lawrence, Kansas, titled East Meets West. The second half of the concert began with Jeff playing a duet with David Balakrishnan, violinist with the famed Turtle Island String Quartet. Well, that concludes part one of my conversation with Jeff. In part two, we talk about playing the bass using a bow and how playing for tango dancers helped Jeff develop a technique all his own. He also talks about a special teacher he met in France who has taught him how to avoid injury while fostering a spirit of curiosity.
Thank you for listening to Rosin the Bow, an audio journey through the world of the violin family. Rosin the Bow is produced by Joe and Paula McHugh in the studios of the Raven Radio Theater in partnership with WTJU-FM and the University of Virginia. Our theme music was arranged and performed by the string quartet, The Fretless. To learn more about Rosin the Bow podcasts, please visit our website, rosinthebow.org. We would like to thank the Kansas University School of Music for hosting our visit to Lawrence, Kansas, and Kansas Public Radio for the generous use of their studios. Wherever we travel in this world, we find a great love of music among people of all backgrounds and ages. We hope you have enjoyed this podcast, and we'll listen again to Rosin the Bow.